You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Andy Milburn's joining us. He doesn't know that, even though I've never sung karaoke, I don't if that's how you say that word. If I decided to sing Toby Keith, Dead Fucking Ringer. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Boom. Yeah.
Yeah. Boom. Yeah. Boom, bitch. Take that.
That was
Toby Keith.
That's certainly an icebreaker, man.
There you go. There you go. Are you a karaoke guy? Or do you do that?
Yeah. Not in a while, though.
What is your...
Ring of Fire. Now, I'm pretty sure that there are some of the denizens of Club Texas in Hinoco back at circa 1990 are still talking about Lieutenant Andy Milburn's rendition of Ring of Fire. I mean, I would bring people to their knees.
I would venture to say that would have been something to behold. But you know, you should have been able to do it, because one of the interesting phenomenons when you go west from the United States to Asia is you find people that can sing the Beatles, right?
Oh yeah,
with no accent, yeah. but don't speak English,
and phenomenally well. Right. I mean, that's what I love about the Philippines is you can go into any downtown bar and just hear a world class band.
Amazing.
You know, and that's before you started drinking.
Exactly, I mean, exactly. Not very much before, but slightly before.
Long way from those of you who visited Club, I think it was just called The Stumps there in 29 Palms, where they used to have Friday night, karaoke night. And so, you know, every Lance Corporal in 7th Marines who fancied himself on American Idol would line up to sing there. And my biggest mistake was that was where I took my wife on our first date.
No way.
Yeah, we're still married, but it's a shot.
Wow. She must have really wanted to go out with you then, because... That's not a good call. What were you thinking about? Why did you think that would be a good idea?
I was desperate, man. I just couldn't believe that she wanted to date me, and she drove all the way from Camp Pendleton up to visit me.
You went into shock and did something really stupid then, huh?
Yeah, I'm not. I don't think well on my feet under pressure. I'm gonna admit.
There you go. Let's. I want to have you on, and I've been traveling. You've been doing the same, and to talk about the Abadati raid. Now, Andy's background is maybe you should just be that should be your call sign, Randy.
I like it.
Andy's background is as a MARSOC guy and as a special operations guy, and so he's done this before. So I want to explain a few things, Andy. When you have this kind of time to deliberately plan an event like this, how big of a factor in the overall success of this is, hey, we think this is him, and we're going to begin planning, right, and rehearsing. How big of an edge is it? I mean, supposedly, from what we hear in open sources, I mean, they had not positively identified him, but had an inclination it was him going back to last summer. So what does that allow you to do? Because, I mean, if you look where the raid is geographically, that ain't close. That is
out near Idlib and paradoxically, you know, I mean, as we now learn, he was being sheltered by, a group who were actually, you know, he declared war on. I mean, a subset of Al-Qaeda. And, so by some devil's bargain, ISIS was paying these guys to look after him, and of course it didn't go well for him. So, you know, up front, and for those of your of your listeners who are understandably skeptical and cynical, you know, I have to say, no, I was nothing. I had nothing to do on the inside with the Baghdadi raid. I would love to claim otherwise, but I didn't. So
come on, you're not going to tell us that whole song and dance about teaching in the Philippines is actually a cover?
Yeah.
As you were riding the dog down that tunnel?
Isn't that amazing what a fanfare they've made about the dog? You know, I'm a little torn about that.
Well, let me just tell you, years from now, right, people are going to say, hey, do you remember that Al-Baghdadi raid? And people are going to go, is that the one with the dog?
That's right.
That's how that raid will be known.
I mean, and there's just no use getting frustrated about that sort of thing, I guess. I mean, I'm a dog lover myself, but good Lord, the number of dudes who we've lost in the wars and who deserve to be remembered, but the dog.
Well, you gotta give them something though, right?
Because no, I agree,
right? Because Delta's not going to give them anything.
Right? Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So anyway, I'm sorry, Mac. Back to your question, and I already kind of laid out the disclaimer up front. But so there's always an element of uncertainty until you've matched up Humid, you know, what you think is Humid with reliable sources, although that in itself, I mean, it is very hard to find. You match that up, you match up signals intelligence, and obviously I'll keep this unclassed, but you can only achieve a certain level of certainty because people trade selectors around. Right. Humans notoriously uncertain, even if, you know, in the... However, reliable source has proven, the oldest adage is you don't fall in love with any single source.
Right.
But they needed, so they had, and I don't know exactly who it was, but they had a dude who was close to Baghdadi, you guys have all read about this, who specified that he was in a certain location, and then they had other human backing it up, and I presume too that Sigyn had led them, you know, down the same trail, but they still needed the clincher, right, in order to meet that mission versus risk trigger to launch the mission.
Okay, we're going to talk about this, but just so everybody understands, can you just real quick, Humid, Sigyn, could you explain that to people
that aren't
savvy?
So when you are launching any sort of operation based on intelligence, whether it is going after an individual or going after a specific, location, you obviously use as many sources of intelligence as you can to arrive at a higher degree of certainty. And, anyone involved in that business will tell you there is never such a thing as dead certainty, but you get as close as you can, right? So they're referring, you use different human sources. By that, those are people who've either specifically recruited or they are people who are working with people whom you have recruited. And I say whom you have recruited, again, those guys who are listening to this are saying, oh, he's going to go into, you know, techniques and procedures. No, I'm not. I'm just saying.
No, I do want you...
It's a laborious business. It's a very laborious business to recruit a source. It isn't simply, you know, hey, I'm going to pay this dude to give me...
So that's what I want. Just real quick, I want you to get... So Humid is human intelligence, and so that means people. And so, and I want you to, and to talk real quick about, as this thing happens, right, and until you kind of get a glimpse into this world, you know, what's a Class A source? What's a Class B source? What's a Class C source? And so, you know, I venture to say, you know, the guys that they were using had never, ever, ever, you know, gone to that side before. And so there's risk that goes with all of that. And so would you talk about, you know, level of sources and how those sources get categorized?
Yeah, absolutely. So I won't go into exact specifics on how right. sources are categorized, but so you already kind of played into that by saying there is an objective means as possible for rating the reliability of a particular source, based on, you know, what he has given you in the past, based on what's called validation, so that previously you've checked things that he has given to you by other means and found them to be correct, or things that he has told you have proven to be correct. But also, he's got to have something called placement, and you've got to verify that he or she genuinely is in a position to give you the information that he claims to have, and that it is not hearsay, that he himself or herself has it at first hand. Because, of course, the further away you get and the more you find yourself playing Chinese whispers, the more chance there is that something has gone awry, because there is every incentive in the world for a source to make up stories, and that is what that is what guys in the human business understand and have to keep foremost, however much they may really believe a particular source. And here's the other danger in this too: if you are in the business of human intelligence and you have put in, and as I said, a tremendous amount of effort to recruit a source, with all the integrity in the world, there's part of you that's going to want to believe what he tells you, right? Or believe that it's, the connection. So sitting over this, pulling the strings, whether it's an operations guy or an intel guy or, the commander of a unit that's pulling all of this together, you want not just more than one source, but you want more than one type of source. So in other words, not just human intelligence, but you want to verify by other means. And the other means might be, drones. And I'll use layman's terms, drones with full motion video, or cameras, or via signals intelligence picking up, as it may suggest, conversations directly from telephone or cell phones, or from, as was often the case with ISIS, via some of the apps they used. WhatsApp, for instance, was they used extensively, at least during the earlier days, 2014 through 2016, for a lot of their tactical operations. And it took us a while, actually, to crack into that. I believe I'm still on the unclassified side of this. So you've got a lot of really super smart, nerdy people, very, very expert in their particular field, but very, very much specialists. And what it needs is that expertise to pull all this together and integrate it into the bigger picture. So you want to verify, however you first pick up
what happens is, there's people invested in this, right? So
absolutely. You're like months, years of their lives.
Right. And so they're going to come to you when this thing begins to brew, right? They're going to come to you. The advocates are going to come, and this is him, right? If you look at this problem, if you will, geographically where he is, right, is not near us. So we're going to have to solve that, and we're going to send people deep into bad guy country, right? And so that, entails risk. And so we have to be right, okay? And so somebody's going to say yes or no to this thing, okay?
Yep.
And a commander is. And you're going to have ops guys who don't believe it. You're going to have intel guys who don't believe it. And then you're going to have the advocates. What Andy was describing is the validation process of this guy is saying this. All right. Can we confirm that this guy is what he is? All right. And that's how you work your way up as a source, right? You have to report, repeatedly, and your reports have to be you know, have to be, you know, accurate. And then you become, you know, and then you kind of work your way up as a, to be a source. And at different level sources can action different activities. If you're a Class C source, you can action, you know, certain things. So it's this process of validation that is, that when you get into this business and you're going to put people's lives at risk, it's really important, and you got to try to get your emotion out of it, right? Which is hard because, you know, as Andy said, I mean, guys have been working for years on this stuff.
And it's so a it's fascinating hard. Human field.
Right.
You know, so you and I are, we're knuckle draggers. And like you, you know, I've had to learn, I've had a steep learning curve since I was a battalion commander, and then getting to MARSOC and realizing that one, and this is no exaggeration, you know, by when we deployed to Iraq 2016, I had a greater intelligence capability in a single MSOC, the single Marine Special Operations team, than I had in my battalion headquarters as battalion infantry, as a infantry battalion commander. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, amazing.
But, you know, getting back to your point is understanding the value that all of these dudes bring to the game. And in the MARSOC side of the house, I think we've got a bit of an advantage. I'm not saying over JSOC, I'm just saying over other components, because all of our guys are Marines. So there isn't such a barrier, and I think most MARSOC guys would agree this, with, you know, the, for instance, the SIGIN dudes that we have down at team level. Most MARSOC operators recognize the value that they bring, and that for, you know, as a target is evolving, you will find the operators working in support of the intel guys, often vice, you know, rather than vice versa, you know, being sent out to find certain things in support of the intel collection effort. So it's a fascinating field. It's a very human enterprise. You know, there's technical aspects of it, but as you pointed out and I mentioned earlier, it can get very emotional because of the time and effort that these guys put into this. I mean, you know, I've witnessed conversations where you have guys who are they're expert at PED for, you know, full motion video. PED is exploitation analysis of video. So they will track certain targets, certain guys over the course of months, maybe even years, and be able to recognize just at a distance from the drone at drone camera, you know, pointing down from whatever it is, you know, to 6,000 feet, they will be able to recognize the way a guy walks without even seeing his face, that he is a particular person.
I want to give everybody a stupid example of this. In the movie The Longest Day, there's a German intelligence officer, right? No, the movie's Patton, right? The German intelligence officer has read Patton's stuff, right? He's read everything about Patton, and he appears in the movie at various times saying, no, he does not think like that. No, right? You know, he's lived with Patton, and he comes in and he kind of tells about, he's kind of this alter ego in the movie guy where he comes in and he gives you kind of, you know, what the Germans think Patton was doing. But it's knowing the subject in that detail, right, that you spend, you know, years, you know, of your life, right, in search of this guy. And because of the stakes. So we talked about human, right? Obviously everybody, you know, has seen drone footage and whatnot. But there's a electronic collections, not only full motion video, but other things that we have that collect as well. All this is part of putting a mosaic together that confirms what the source says. Is that in the run up to it?
Or yes, so it's confirming. It's it's pinning certain designators to that source that make it increasingly probable that he is in that location. By that, so for instance, we talk about signals intelligence. You know, signals, and again, the SIGINT guys who are listening are going to be pulling their hair out at, you know, this kind of the Neanderthal explanation of signals intelligence. I got to break it down for most of the your listeners who are probably like me. You're throwing out. Yeah, I mean, think how many people are on cell phones nowadays, and so you begin by throwing out a massive net, and then you're trying to trace patterns within all the fish that swim into that net, and then pick out particular ones. And I know fish isn't a good analogy, but you're trying to pick out it basically comes down to a certain handset and associate it with a particular person.
Well, it's not a bad analogy, Andy, because what you're trying to, if everybody can try to imagine this, all the cellular communications, and satellite communications that are going on, and you cast a net over that, and you're looking, and you're looking for a single fish. That's right.
And by simulating, often simulating a cell tower, so you're attracting all of these calls, and then one of the biggest challenges the signals intelligence guys will tell you is analysis.
Right.
You can try and locate someone via a different specific selector, but there's so many problems attached to that. And then trying to analyze the snippets of conversation that you do pick up. The vast majority of signals intelligence that we collect, people will tell you, you just lack the capacity to analyze. But where I'm heading on this is that it's quite miraculous when you factor in that, you factor in how many cell phones are being used, you factor in that groups like ISIS and indeed Al-Qaeda before them became very, very savvy about not using cell phones. And then on the occasions that they did, they started communicating via apps, as I mentioned, that were, a lot harder to crack into. So signals intelligence has become increasingly sophisticated. And again, I'm on thin ice here, so I don't want to out my level of expertise. When we go to 5G, I can only imagine it's going to get even worse. But say you do actually attach a handset, you can match a handset to a person, but of course that is, people discard handsets all the time. Right. So it's a very nebulous connection.
Got it. Talk to me about, as you begin to rehearse, as you begin to develop that piece, and so the ops guys, are going to say, all right, we're going to begin to construct a compound that's an exact replica of this. The assets that I've seen that the soft community has are pretty formidable. And I know you don't have any, you don't know this, but for a fact in this case, but would an exact replica have been built of that compound that they would have rehearsed on for, days and probably weeks?
Yeah, I can't imagine that they didn't have that. When you think about it, Mac, that even in, remember the PME on the Sante raid that we used to go through at IOC. Even back then, that was considered something that you absolutely had to have, was rehearse on the ground over and over again in order to reduce that risk factor, not just risk to people involved, but most importantly, the risk itself. What is fascinating about this one, though, and this is just me speculating, was the fact that Baghdadi escaped down a tunnel. They appeared to know about the tunnel. Our guys appeared to know about it. I don't know if they had mapped it out, if they managed to map it once they were on the ground, if they had ground-penetrating radar,
right,
if they had human beforehand that told them, where it was. But one thing that we've learned over and again in the campaign against ISIS, as we've learned in earlier wars, with all our technology, tunnels are a stupefying weapon. You know, I mean, we, time and time again, we watch, even with our own guys on the ground, we watch ISIS be able to use tunnels, not just to escape from an objective area, but to launch counterattacks, to mass and launch counterattacks. And it was notoriously difficult for us to counter that. And, you know, again, I'm skating
right
on the right side of unclassified, but we didn't have the resources that we thought we had in the inventory to map tunnels. And, in fact, there's only, you know, there was like one airborne platform that we could use to, you know, to locate tunnels. Once you're closer to the ground, it's a little easier. But so that part of this mission, I find very interesting. You know, I wonder whether they had to map that tunnel.
So hold on, I want to ask you about that comment you made. Once you're closer to the ground, it's a little bit easier. So the dilemma is, we think he's there. We cannot do anything that arouses any kind of suspicion, or he'll leave and we'll lose this. And so you have to do this stuff from afar, and afar has its limitations.
Yeah, you still there?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, and again, things may have improved in the last few years, but trying to map out exactly where tunnels go, unless you're on the ground with ground penetrating radar, is a very, very difficult task. So, I've got to add again, I'm speculating, so people aren't listening, thinking I'm...
No, and just so everybody, knows, Andy's not on the inside on this. And so what I love to have people do, and I don't care if we talk about aviation mishaps, is come on and explain things to us that, you know, we don't rightly have the, most of us don't have the experiences. I got a short glimpse. 13 years ago, for God's sake. You know, and times change very, very quickly, and technology does, and capabilities do, and so it's always cool to have somebody, you know, with more recent experience, and Andy a lot more experience. Andy, what about the challenges of just getting there in the air undetected? I remember when the Bin Laden raid happened, to me, one of the most impressive things was, who got told? How do they keep it a secret? How do they get there undetected that far into Pakistan? And when I plotted this, you know, where the farm was, you know, you're like, holy shit, man, they're almost to Israel.
Yeah.
That has some challenges to go with it.
Through Syrian and Russian controlled airspace, you know, I don't know. Have you heard anything on about, you know, prior coordination?
No.
I can't imagine there was.
Neither can I, because you right.
Must have been flying at ground level.
So Andy, talk about that. Why would we not tell the Russians, the Turks, or the Syrians that we were coming?
Yeah, that's a... I'm sure the question came up, and I don't know... I don't know what the answer was. I think in this case, just because it, you know, even if you don't suspect that the Russians would directly pass this on, that, that they, there was, you know, the Syrian military itself, as I'm sure, is infiltrated, and that, you know, by some means this would get back to the guys who are protecting Baghdadi, who, remember, we're not ISIS. We're actually opposed to ISIS.
Right. So that's my thoughts exactly that, you know, because neither Turkey nor Russia has made a comment publicly about this.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough. And my sentiment was the same as yours is if you tell them there's, you know, I think everybody sitting in the room would say it's not a 50-50 chance he's going to find out. Right. It is probably a 90. We believe 90% probability, he'll be warned, and he won't be there. And this has been too hard. Is there a part? And will you explain something to people? Talk about, so in the planning phase of this, right? If this is him, and as we kind of lean into it, right, and after we get the DNA, like, it's him, okay?
Yeah.
Can you just explain to people what sensitive side exploitation is and what happens after this relative to pursuit of other high-value targets that may be implicated by, you know, digital technology, emails, and things that you're going to find on different devices in the compound?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is such a big deal now that all we train all our guys, certainly in MARSOC, and, you know, even conventional forces, every unit now has a site exploitation team who are, at least in the infantry, who are trained to gather material in the immediate aftermath of taking the objective. And material could be anything. You know, it's everything from documents, laptops, weapons, everything. But the real challenge is then to process, analyze, and disseminate that information rapidly. And so, you know, obviously no one can rival Task Force, but in MARSOC we had a exploitation lab, actually with the Siege of SODIF. And so whenever us or our partner nation forces grab this material, we turn it directly into the lab, for processing. But we're always behind the power curve. So, you know,
can you explain the race between people living around him getting on their phones and telling other people, hey, somebody's just blown that whole thing up, right? We need to execute operation, you know, somewhere over the rainbow. And now they begin to implement their emergency, escape, right? And evade stuff that they do. And so there's this race between secondary targets that might be implicated by something you would find, right? And the information to get them, and they're moving. So talk about that.
Yeah. So what stacked against this is the fact that ISIS is a really savvy organization. As you said, will have had automatic plans that when one of their number is certainly someone as high up as Baghdadi was rumbled, that anyone remotely connected with him would have gone through go undercover, go black comms plan, assuming right away that their location was known based on what they know about our ability to exploit stuff. But here's something that counts in our favor. ISIS is meticulous about recording details. It's extraordinary. And so time and again, you know, we've come across pay records, in Mosul, tax records, all kinds of things that have enabled us to go after, obviously not as important targets as in this case, but certainly ISIS leaders. I don't think, you know, of course there's no organization in the world that can rival Task Force for the ability now, thanks to
hold on, let me
exploit this stuff.
When you say Task Force, explain to everybody what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm just using kind of the generic term for, what used to be known as Delta Force. But Delta Force, not just not just the door kickers, but by the Task Force, I mean, you know, all the intel guys,
the entire
piece.
And the whole piece is pretty impressive.
It's been finely tuned, as you all know, over the course of the last few decades. And so whereas, you know, I mean, McChrystal tells great stories about back in 2003 and 2004 of them doing a series of successive raids, and then they would capture boxes and boxes of stuff. And it would just sit there in a warehouse because they would have maybe a fire team of intel going through it all, and they just didn't have the capacity to analyze it. So they were doing great stuff, but it was blind. And a lot was a lot of what they used to do successfully was based on their tactical questioning on the ground, but which, by the way, is another form of site exploitation and a very effective one. But now where everything kind of goes into the machine, you know, the Gauntlator, as soon as they grab it, and everyone is poised, ready to react on that intel as it gets disseminated. I mean, it is exponential.
Can you explain? So as part of this, are there series of teams that know that there's going to be intel that shakes loose out of this, and they're going to develop it and go? Because it's not like we haven't done this before,
The assumption will always be that when you hit a target, that there are going to be follow-on targets from the intel that gets exposed. So yes, you will have in the planning phase, you will set fresh teams aside and fresh intel guys aside, just to focus on that stuff and direct them in the right direction. And obviously in this case it worked, you know, and they got Baghdadi's immediate successor, you know, almost right away.
Right.
But hey, you know, Matt, I'm overjoyed, just like everyone else, about Baghdadi being killed. But sadly, you know, this is the hydra we're dealing with, and there's a couple of things that
hold on, you're gonna talk us out of the mission accomplished event?
Oh yeah, no, I'm sorry. No, let's look back.
Damn it, I hate that. Let's
look back. Remember when Sakali was killed?
Yes.
And we were all very happy about that, but you know, the zenith of Al Qaeda's violence in Iraq actually occurred after Zakawi's death.
Right.
I mean, he was, you know, he was the sheikh of the slaughterers and all of that. But
Andy, and if you, anybody who's kind of paid attention to this stuff, you know, we're hunting these people, okay? I mean, and that is a lot of pressure on anybody on the planet. When the United States is hunting you, so the measures you have to take, and Andy kind of alluded to them a few minutes ago, the measures you have to take, you have to electronically isolate yourself. And so you cannot
reduce your effectiveness to command and control.
Yeah, you cannot be a part of it on a day-to-day basis, maybe even on a week-to-week basis, maybe on a month-to-month basis, because if you do, the odds of you dying, right, and your symbolic significance to the organization, and in their view, we're going to give them a win. And we cannot allow, you know, so Bin Laden, right? He was a symbolic figure. He was not anything in their operations anymore, because he couldn't be. And do you think at Baghdadi, from what you've read, you know, just in the news, any sense of how, you know, was Baghdadi still involved in the operational planning and things like that? Or had he been, you know, had he been so sequestered that he could not participate anymore?
Well, I think there's a combination of factors. So the bottom line is, you know, we didn't remove the icon that Baghdadi was in, say, 2014 through 2016, when there was a physical caliphate with a real army numbering tens of thousands of dudes, and he was a strategic as well as a spiritual figurehead. So there's a number of factors against, you know, that mitigated against him being no longer important. One of which was the fact that we were hunting him so relentlessly, as you point out, but he no longer really had a field army to represent or command. He was still perhaps spiritually important, and that is really, I think, where all of us now recognize the threat of the Islamic State lies is in its spiritual rebirth elsewhere, and it's already, as you know, popping up at other places in the world. So hard to gauge how much of a blow to that effort his loss will be, but not that great, you know? I mean, how, simply because we haven't, Baghdadi hasn't been foremost, even in ISIS's own news over the course of the last year or so. He's ceased to be the figurehead that he was.
Right.
Don't get me wrong, I'm as happy as the next guy about removing him.
No, but I don't think
for a moment that it's going to alter the threat that ISIS poses. And the threat is no longer the very small rump of the caliphate that remains in the Middle East. The threat, as we know, is popping up elsewhere around the world and lives on in the ideology.
Andy, I want you to, the dog, it has been featured, you know, and, you know, the American public, you know, obviously has taken to that. But those dogs are weapons, and they're pretty formidable weapons. Can you explain to people the benefit that those dogs allow teams as they close on a compound that may or may not be booby-trapped at certain periods of night and in terms of gaining access and what those animals do?
Well, you know the expression standoff, right? You know, it's an expression we use all the time. It's putting distance between yourself and the threat. And that's what dogs do. That's what those dogs do. They are, for a number of reasons, they're the weapons. They're superb weapons. One, they're psychologically terrifying, and there's admittedly cultural issues too. But also, you know, I mean, anyone who's seen those dogs, trained and, you know, put on the attack, fully understand what a ferocious weapon they are and how they move so quickly, you know, especially that when it's dark, that they can absolutely, and they come from unexpected directions, so they absolutely counter even small arms at let's face it, no risk, at low risk to their human operators, which is really what this is about. I mean, it's why we use them. The multi-purpose canines that are also, you know, used for counter ID, but also to go after people.
No, and you can imagine. I mean, as Andy says, the standoff part of this is, you know, that now instead of the first person through that breach being a human, in that chaotic confusion, smoke, and you know, and then guys shooting into the smoke, you know, you have this rocket that goes through there. And and whatever it encounters, it's not going to be a pleasant outcome for whatever they encounter.
Right. And they're not distracted. You can't distract them. You know, once they get their teeth on someone, it's the only the handler can pull them off.
Is there any part of this raid that caught your eye more than anything else? We talked about the distance that they had to go. You know, we talked about, you know, really to me, to get his DNA, that's pretty impressive when somebody's on the run like that, and which is an amazing job by whoever, you know, cultivated the source and developed it and to do that kind of work. And that's pretty amazing. We've talked about him being like all their top guys. You know, the guys below them have some operational freedom but the number one guys are almost live in a state of quarantine. Is there any part of the operation that you found more interesting than any other?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the hardest problems here, and again, I'm not pretending to be an expert, but one of the hardest problems when you get on the ground and think, you know, it's dark, it's chaotic, is actually finding your target. The terminal guidance piece is all important. Doesn't matter how well you have rehearsed or laid out the model in the dark, trying to find a single dude with a lot of chaos going on when he is no longer in the place where you expect him to be, is a tremendously difficult task. And so by terminal guidance, I mean that, you know, typically you will have some means on the ground to help you with that. And it may be human, and maybe someone who's linked up with you on the ground, who guides you that last part, or says, no, he has just moved, he is not here. It may be technical, it may be, signals intelligence, but the problem with that is, of course, the target has to be using a phone. But I wonder, in this particular case, it seems to me they must have had some terminal guidance to know that he had gone down a tunnel. I mean, think about it. You've worn NVGs, and you've been in situations, maybe not as chaotic like that, but in combat or even in peacetime, doing a raid, right. Training. It's not easy. It's not easy. You've got a bunch of dudes running around to find one particular guy, especially if he has gone underground. And so that part particularly intrigues me. In the Bin Laden raid, it was a little bit different, right? Because he was in a compound, he was in the house, he remained in that house, he was where he was expected to be. But not in this case. He had bolted. And so being able to, for the force on the ground to move, take the actions they did, suggests to me that they had some really good terminal guidance, whatever it may have been.
I want to ask you a question, and if you can't or don't if you can or don't want to answer, don't be afraid to say it. But we have the drones that the SOF community has access to are pretty incredible. As when they get on the ground, are there drone guys talking to specific guys? So
yeah.
If my job is to whack the guy who stands at that corner of that building every night, is there somebody telling me, Mac, he's right at target reference point 2, right?
Yeah.
Is there somebody talking in these kind of operations that are so sophisticated? Are there people helping? Are they going to be in my headset saying he's right? He's right where we said he'd be. He hasn't moved. He just moved to the other window, right, and helping me get my eyeballs on that guy?
Yes. Yes, certainly there are. And, the discussions between the IPCs, the guys operating the drones, and the guys on the ground, is continuous. And that may have been how they spotted him. But, again, I doubt it because he went into a tunnel, which is... Again, no tourist leader spot even from a drone, but it just gets back to yes, this is it's difficult to envision how complex an operation something like this is. And as you mentioned, you factor in the level of risk and the distance and everything else.
Let me ask you. Here's another question. Here's an aviation question for you, right? Yeah, evidently, its point of origin is Al-Asad. They rehearsed in Erbil. And, but getting there, at some point, somebody's got to refuel something, which means either FARP or aerial refueling, or that piece in and of itself is not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Not at all. Think that Desert One. Right. That's where it all came apart, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, locating a FARP in that, although there's expanses of open desert there, there's also, as we talked about on the Syrian side, that's desert that's nominally owned by forces that are not friendly to the United States. So I don't know. I don't know where they did that, but yes, you're right. That's another level of complexity in the planet.
So, yeah, I just found it interesting that neither Russia nor Turkey nor Syria said a word about it, which I don't know that our OPSEC's that good. I don't know that our relations with those countries is good. And I think it's more apt that they didn't know anything about it, and we're almost embarrassed that the United States could actually do something like this without them being aware of it. Which if that is the case, that is obviously very, very, very impressive. All right, Andy, what haven't I been smart enough that I have? And again, I think, we've all, we were talking about a few minutes ago, back away from the mission accomplished event. We've all seen this repeatedly, and you referred to ISIS as a hydra. So your thumbnail, you know, from afar, you know, what impact does this actually have on ISIS and on the conflict that continues to go on there?
So sadly, I think very little impact. And here's why I'm saying this. So even at the height of Baghdadi's power, one thing that we realized in 2016, and this was just learning lessons in Iraq fighting ISIS, was that the greatest impact that we could have on them was not necessarily taking out the higher level leaders. And we, you know, by we, I mean the United States at the time was having some success against ISIS leadership. It was much lower. It was at the tactical level. They're platoon commanders, they're company commanders, and battalion. In battalion levels, probably as low as I would go. There was one particular, and that was a lesson we learned, and here's what I mean by that. So, if you look at a battle like the Battle for Ramadi, 2015 to 2016, it was a long, hard slog to win back Ramadi from ISIS. And we U.S. SOF had not yet realized, that the best way of helping our Iraqi counterparts was not just to, you know, bring down block after block in front of the advancing forces, but go after the tactical level leadership of the defenders. And it took a while, but by the time it came to Fallujah and then Ritba, we'd become very good at that. And so,
can you expand on that?
So by various means, we figure out who controlled their tactical formations in the fight, who directed, you know, they weren't using terms platoons, but who directed one unit to go here, another there, who pulled together their counterattacks when Iraqi special forces were making a breakthrough. And once we identified those guys, we worked out how they communicated among themselves, whether it was digital radio, whether it was via apps, and then the third part was to break into that and target those guys and then take them out, target them, i.e. killing them, removing them, close enough before the attack so that they could not be replaced. And that worked very well in Fallujah. It worked supremely well in Ritba, thanks to some... And this was covered in a New York Times article, so I can talk about it freely. But just virtuoso targeting by the Special Operations Task Force, U.S. Special Operations Task Force out there, who took out a dude named Abu Wahib, who was like the, you know, the top tactical level leader in Ritba. And Iraqi Special Forces took that place almost without a single casualty. And it was not just Wahib, but it was all his tactical level leaders had been nailed, you know, before the attack. And so figuring that out was really kind of the key to understanding how ISIS worked. Don't get me wrong, for every reason that you've given, Mac, it makes sense to go after higher level leadership. I'm not for a moment negating that, and I'm not for a moment trying to reduce the reduce the extraordinary feat that this was. I'm just trying to be a realist about.
No, but time and again, we have seen their ability to regenerate leadership, regenerate combat power, and I want you to make one final point. So it's not only that you're going to kill him; it's the timing of when you kill him.
That's exactly right.
So as the attack either breaks through or pushes, when they need him to step into the breach and pull this thing together, he's now dead.
Yep.
And because of the time and the situation, they can't get anybody else there to replace him, and so they are now disjoined and they lack concert in their efforts in the face of this attack.
and there's no voice on the radio right. telling them what to do.
Telling them what
and
to
this
do.
Is one thing, this is a very interesting insight into ISIS, and we used to listen to them just for force protection reasons on the radios up on the forward line of troops because, we'd get indications of an attack. And the ISIS guys in the forward positions sounded like a bunch of lance corporals. They bitch about pay. A lot of them had got, married to girls who probably had no choice. They complained about, their wives. They would complain about being relieved late when they're on duty and, all these things. But we noticed that they would fight with a happy heart even if they knew that there was just no way out. It was extraordinary. But they would not fight if they thought that their immediate leadership was not there with them. And this is both foreign fighters and the Iraqis themselves. If they had their equivalent of a platoon commander or company commander or battalion commander on the radio exhorting them to do the right things, it's not that they necessarily needed that level of direction. It was a morale piece.
Right.
But absent that voice, if that guy was suddenly gone, then they would break and run. And that was the only time that they would. It's a very interesting comment about morale because they weren't, by and large, weren't afraid of death in the same way that you and I are.
Andy, first of all, I want to thank you for doing this. I love bringing smart guys on and have great experiences and explain some of the things that the nuances of things that happen, whether they be special operations, aviation, or infantry related. I think it always helps people to understand because even if you were an infantryman, infantry operations are vastly different than they were 10 years ago. 5 years ago, and the soft communities changes. Yeah, the soft community changes at the speed of light as technology and opportunities and your opponent changes. There are hydras on both sides, and so it's always cool to bring smart guys on and to kind of footnote things to the extent that we can, relying on open sources. So first of all, welcome home, and thank you very much for doing this.
Hey, Mac, thank you for everything you do for All Marine Radio, and I think I commented last time I spoke to you, your reach is far and wide, and I got an email from a Canadian buddy of mine who's not even a Marine, just saying how much he enjoys listening to your podcast, so awesome. Credit to you, bro.
I appreciate it. Andy Milmer, more of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Oops, wasn't quite supposed to end like that, but anyway, my thanks to Andy for doing that. Pretty interesting, huh? I mean, that's why you can't replace, guys like that who will come on and talk just about their experience. And again, none of that's classified, but Andy relating, that those points at the end of the interview about they'll fight and die with a happy heart as long as they know their leaders are there. And then the other point about the timing, I heard General Zinni say that in that PME that I talk about so much in 1990. And he talks about doing an exercise in Korea, and they found the command post of the other regiment, I think. It was either regiment or battalion. And then he said, the Artie guys immediately go crazy. Let's shoot it. He said, no, we're not shooting it. They said, what? Not shooting it. Not the right time. We're going to shoot it after we've begun the attack. And as they're spooling to do things, we're going to kill it at a point in time that they cannot regenerate this. If we kill it, if we do it now, they'll regenerate the capability, blah, 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 blah. It's the first time I heard that. So, I've been thinking about the whole... what happened in Mexico, and relative to the president's handling of what's gone on in Syria, I'm not the biggest fan. In case you don't know, yeah, I am not. I will say this though, I would be more than happy if he used his gut to say, I have, as the President of the United States, I've designated those organizations as international terrorist organizations. And the full weight and power of the American military and every other asset of this nation, we have declared war on them. Because, you know, we've talked about this relative to his electronic warfare. So because you come into the country electronically, or, you know, surreptitiously through the internet, it's not an act of war? The damage you do? Not an act of war. Wow. Pretty cool concept that you can essentially be at war electronically with somebody, but because there's no outward manifestation other than you looting them of classified material that is essentially billions of dollars in military secrets and other things like that to blackmail people, that's not an act of war because it doesn't fit in the classic definition of such. Yeah, I think we need to get over that. I think if somebody were to invade our country and do the damage that these organizations do, and again, you know, ISIS is the same thing. It is a stateless organization that attempted to, right, create a nation. Well, that's what these cartels are. They attempted to buy a nation, Mexico. And now the game, the game that they play in Mexico is, look, we know we bought this son of a bitch, okay? Now, we don't care if you play charades and, you know, and kowtow to the people. And we don't really care if you kill some of our guys. But don't come sniffing where you don't belong, all right? We're willing to play charades because we know how, you know, this thing plays in Peoria. But do not make the mistake of trying to take this country back. We bought it. Fair and square. We have the receipts. We can show them to you. So, his gut doesn't always do the right thing. I hope he follows his gut and says, yeah, we're going to get after them in a big way. In a big way. We're going to find them. We're going to destroy them. And Mexico, sorry, we don't see eye to eye. So you're going to have to get in the back seat. Or you can go sit in the backyard, put your head between your legs, because you don't own your country anymore. And we're going to do something about it. We're going to make it hurt. So it's just ridiculous. And this is just the latest incident, right? And we haven't even discussed, like, oh, maybe some of this exists because of the shit show that is our southern border that the Democratic Party won't do anything with. Yeah, that's pretty nice. All right. Don't touch that dial. Today's show, pretty interesting. If you're just tuning in and you missed the first hour, Jeff Kenney, yesterday was on, and he was in Tehran as an embassy guard when he was a, Lance Corporal. He'd been in the Marine Corps 14 months, and Jeff is a squared away guy and got selected for the Marine Security Guard program, went to, MSG school, Marine Security Guard school, and then was sent to Tehran where he spent 1970, part of 76 and part of 77, and then he went someplace else. Normally they do two tours. So, and Jeff did that. And so, you'll hear about that. But in the first hour, what I did was, I took some of the audio from yesterday, which is straight up hilarious. I've had more people send me emails about just Jeff recounts a fight he got into with the detachment gunnery sergeant. Okay. he said, I'm drunk, right? I'm a corporal and, I'm drunk. I'm a corporal. And the gunny says, Kenny, you're drunk. Get out of here. And then he essentially says, I'm on libo. You can't tell me what to do. And he said, in fact, why don't we go outside and I'll kick your ass. And so they go outside. And Jeff, I won't spoil it. Jeff recounts the story. And just suffice it to say, it's really funny. So So give that a listen to. I play some audio when we're going through the news about a couple of different interviews. One, a guy named Whitaker, former attorney general. He took Jeff Sessions' place, big guy, shaved head, and that guy. I don't know if you remember him. And then there's a second guy named Charles, who's a State Department guy who acts like a State Department, who keeps talking about this is a rules infraction thing. No. I know what a rule infraction is, right? That's stepping over the line. Murdering 9 people, Americans, children, setting their vehicle on fire and burning whoever's still wounded in there to death, and all the drug shit that comes into our country, that is not a rules violation, okay? And if you think it is, you need to get your head out of your ass. So you will hear all of that. And tomorrow, Lynch and Kenny. On Friday, the chef will join us. So it'll be interesting. We'll talk about the Mexican border and how you deal with the drugs. Jeff is, and he'll be interesting because he is, he's well read in the whole organized crime thing and stuff like that. So can we take something like that on as a nation? I cannot imagine that we cannot. So anyway, have a great day on a Tuesday. That is really a Wednesday. All Marine Radio is over and done.